I have to go upstairs and record something again, so...
Quiet.
Do not...
smash anything.
And do not disturb.
Do not disturb.
Do not come into your room.
You're listening to Pandemic, a podcast from RTE News and Current Affairs on the COVID-19 crisis. I'm Colm O'Mungoyne, and each week I'll be talking to RTE's correspondents, reporters and others to bring you news, updates and analysis you can trust. We can guarantee you a high quality of information. Sound quality, on the other hand, might vary somewhat. The correspondents and I will be recording this in many cases on mobile devices from home, so please do bear with us. It's Thursday, the 25th of March, and it's Pandemic Episode 81. For the past 2 weeks, listener, we have tried to parse, analyse and make sense of the approach to vaccination in the European Union, and in particular, what's going on with the AstraZeneca supply and the contract that the European Union agreed with that company. Now, only today, the UK's health secretary boasted that the British contract with the pharma company was superior to that of the EU's, and all of this coming at a time when the leaders of EU governments are meeting to debate the merits and demerits of export controls on vaccines manufactured in the EU. Now, there were figures released today to those leaders by the European Commission at the summit that's currently taking place in Brussels as we record this, as I say, on Thursday. The EU has exported 77 million doses of vaccines to 33 countries. 88 million doses have been supplied to the EU, of which 68 million have been administered, with 18.2 million EU citizens fully vaccinated with two doses. But back to AstraZeneca, who is right on the contract issue? The EU, that it has a tight contract and should be supplied according to what was agreed, or the UK, saying that it has the tighter contract and greater priority in terms of vaccine supply from UK companies? And what other factors are involved? Well, we're going to hear from Gavin Barrett, professor at UCD's Sutherland School of Law and sometime Jean Monnet Professor of European Constitutional and Economic Law there. Okay, Professor Gavin Barrett, thanks very much for joining us on the Pandemic Podcast.
You're welcome.
As both of us were having our morning coffees in different houses, we turned out to be reading the same quote in possibly the same newspaper. So I leave it to you to read it out, that which might be a good basis to kick off our discussion on today's episode of the podcast. It comes courtesy of the UK Health Secretary, Mr. Matt Hancock.
Yes, it's a juicy quote indeed. And the interesting thing about this quote is that it comes pretty much simultaneously with this UK-EU statement promising, if you like, a reciprocally beneficial relationship that's meant to ratchet down tensions. At exactly the same time as that's being issued, Matt Hancock is saying to the Financial Times, "I believe that free trading nations follow the law of contracts. They," in other words, the European Union, "have a best efforts contract and we have an exclusivity deal." He adds to that, "our contract trumps theirs. It's called a contract law. It's very straightforward."
Is it very straightforward?
Well, you know, it does essentially outline at least the contractual state of affairs. We were aware of it. If you dug deeply enough, you were aware of it already, because the chief executive officer of AstraZeneca told a European Parliament hearing a short while ago in February that UK priority came from a research funding agreement that Oxford signed with the UK government in January or February 2020. At that time, AstraZeneca wasn't in on the act, but they then partnered with Oxford in May 2020. So effectively, they inherited that agreement. And this seems to be the basis, therefore, of the contractual blockage, if you like. What's happened, in essence, to summarise for your listeners, is the European Union, and indeed its member states, because, for example, Germany entered into a research agreement with BioNTech, who subsequently partnered up with Pfizer, and they didn't include any kind of vaccine exclusivity arrangement. Pfizer were free to agree to trade vaccines or to supply vaccines to whoever they wanted. And so the European Union adopted a fairly kind of open kind of approach. They didn't want to engage in what we'd call vaccine nationalism, which is closing off the supply of vaccines at the borders of various member states. And there are very good reasons for not wanting to do that, because, you know, there's an international market, if you like, in vaccines and in the products that go into vaccines. So I think the attitude of the European Union was basically that they didn't want to get into that kind of stuff, that kind of protectionist approach. So the net effect of that has been that the European Union has, apart from supplying itself with vaccines, it has supplied vaccines pretty much all over the world. The figures produced by the Commission yesterday indicated that 43 million doses of vaccines have been exported, and of those, 10.9 million of them have been sent to the United Kingdom, which meant, now the figures are changing every day, but it did mean that up to a short time ago, about a third of the vaccines being injected into people's arms in the United Kingdom were actually coming from the European Union. Whereas when it came to vaccines going in the other direction, if you asked yourself, you know, how many vaccines were being exported from the United Kingdom to European Union states, which I would remind your listeners include Ireland, the answer to that is zero. Not one of them has gone in the other direction. So you look around for explanations for that situations. Now, there's such a thing as contract confidentiality, and the United Kingdom has been relying on that very strongly indeed. And there are two contracts, basically.
That's what I was going to ask you, because there are two contracts in the public domain. One is the one the European Union signed with AstraZeneca, which after the initial shortfall in supply, they were very keen to get into the public domain to show that they had negotiated a contract which was robust and with clear timelines. And then subsequently CNN publicised the UK contract that's come into the public domain, and those contracts are largely similar. It's the other contract that you're talking about, is it?
Yeah, there was a lot of attention paid to the differences between the contracts, and there are some differences between the two of them. The United Kingdom one is a bit more tightly worded than the European Union one, but it appears we were looking in the wrong place, because the real place where this comes from another contract, an earlier contract that was signed when the United Kingdom provided money for Oxford to engage in the research that subsequently led to the Oxford AstraZeneca vaccine. But they wrote a clause into that at that time indicating that priority should be given. And this is the clause Matt Hancock was talking about. Priority should be given to the United Kingdom before anyone else. So the net effect of that is that until the United Kingdom's needs are entirely supplied, in other words, effectively everyone in the United Kingdom has been vaccinated, they won't supply one single vaccine. Interestingly enough, actually, that clause doesn't appear to have been directed at the European Union. It was directed at, guess who? Boris Johnson's best pal, Donald Trump, because they were actually very worried about Oxford partnering up with an American corporation, which, if you like, would then hoover all the vaccines over
sure,
there.
Sure, because America at the time had engaged in Operation Warp Speed back in about May 2020 and had put in billions of dollars. And Donald Trump, I think, had floated the prospect of going all in, I think possibly with a German vaccine manufacturer, to try and get exclusivity deals there. So those fears were at the time well grounded.
Yes. So I suppose, notwithstanding all the palsy talk, if you like, between Boris Johnson and Donald Trump, they didn't trust the man further than they could throw him, basically. And they prevented a partnership agreement between Oxford and an American firm and ensured that it would be AstraZeneca at the end of the day. So I suppose they adopted a more cautious approach, and they did lock in, if you like, this obligation regarding the vaccines, but they kept it confidential. The net effect of that then was, as I said, that the European Union, trustingly, if you like, taking it that if they were open in relation to vaccines, if they did not engage in protectionism, vaccine nationalism, whatever you want to call it, that other major economies would do likewise. But in fact, they have not done that. In fact, both the United Kingdom and the United States have engaged in what you just have to call vaccine nationalism at the end of the day. And, you know, this has gone on for quite a period of time. But of course, it's problematic, because if you reserve all of those vaccines to yourself, then the vaccine prevents sickness, it prevents death. Well, the sickness and the death, instead of taking place in the United Kingdom, take place on the European continent. And they take place in Ireland at the end of the day. And European leaders are simply fed up with this. And this is leading to a situation in which the European Commission has now proposed expanding its export authorization system. Now, there's already an export authorization system in place at the moment. You might recall that Italy used it in order to block the export of vaccines, I think about 250,000 of them, to Australia at one stage, and to keep them in Italy. Now, that didn't cause quite as much as a spat as it might have, for a number of reasons, one of which is that the situation in Australia isn't actually as bad as it is in Italy. But the export regime was there, if you like. And what's going on at the moment is that the European Commission is proposing adopting itself, because it can do that, it has the legal power to do so, to adopt an amending regulation, implementing regulation, amending that original regulation. And essentially, that would have two features to it. One of them is what they call a reciprocity clause there. And you can bet the United Kingdom are paying a large amount of attention to this, because it says that export authorization will require the assessment of whether the country of destination of the export is restricting its own exports, either by law, in other words, either by export restrictions or by any other means, including through the conclusion of contractual arrangements with the manufacturer of those goods, which describes pretty well what we've actually seen there. And secondly, that an assessment would need to take place of the conditions prevailing in the country of destination, including the rate of vaccinations there. And now, as we all know, And the United Kingdom vaccination rate, for a number of reasons, has been considerably higher than that, at least its first vaccination rate. And there are, of course, two vaccinations needed. And the United Kingdom has decided, if you like, to give everyone or as many people as possible a first vaccination, and then only months later to turn around and give them the second vaccination. That's quite different to the approach that's adopted in a lot of European countries, including Ireland, where it's been decided they should adhere to the manufacturer's instructions and keep the first and second vaccination doses within more or less about 4 weeks of one another. So, you know, there are a variety of reasons why Britain has done better. Its NHS is, of course, you know, very effective and has done very well there. But of course, another reason for that is that they've actually held on by virtue of this contractual clause, they've held on to the supply of vaccine.
What would be the legal position, generally speaking, if an agreement is signed, albeit with the confidentiality clause, like you say, the one that the UK government and Oxford signed up to? What would have been the obligation on AstraZeneca's part then to disclose details of other contracts it had entered into if they materially affected AstraZeneca's ability to fulfil that contract?
Yeah, there is a clause to that effect in the EU-UK contract. I think AstraZeneca's argument in relation to that would be that their contractual obligation is only to make their best efforts to meet their obligations to the European Union. Now, that is true. The European Union's take on that is that the only reason that clause was put in there was because they had to reach advanced purchase arrangements with a variety of suppliers of vaccines, and it wasn't clear who was going to succeed and who wasn't going to succeed at the end of the day. So there was an element of chance there, and they couldn't have, if you like, pharmaceutical companies at risk of being sued for breach of contract simply because the science didn't work out, as it were. So that's their attitude in relation to AstraZeneca's approach in relation to that, going at least by what Pascal Soriot indicated, that they take that pretty much to indicate that they can do largely what they want in terms of the supplies, because the promised emergence of, I think, initially 100 million vaccines, they've ended up supplying less than half of that at the end of the day. And their best efforts, as far as they're concerned, seem to allow them to divide, if you like, the supply of vaccines from British factories from those from the continental factories, and to say that the continental supply must all come from the continental factories, or the European Union. I shouldn't just say continental, because it's our supply here in Ireland too, that must come from continental factories, and the British supply, well, they can do whatever they want with the factories from there. Now, that's attributing an extraordinarily broad interpretation to the notion of best efforts, in my view, and I'm not really convinced that it would stand up in court. But I suppose the argument there essentially is that it's not preventing us from meeting our contractual obligations, because our contractual obligations are formulated in such woolly terms that we're not in breach of them at all.
What redress is there potentially? Could redress be pursued if the obligations in the contract aren't lived up to?
Yes, they could. And generally, the redress for breach of contractual rights is damages, basically, that AstraZeneca could be sued. Oxford AstraZeneca could be sued in relation to the failure to supply vaccines in the agreed amounts, if that actually is a breach of the contract. I suppose the point about this, though, is that nobody is really that interested in contractual damages at the end of the day. In fact, I think Italy indicated, I haven't heard anything about it recently, but certainly initially, they indicated that they were thinking very strongly of bringing legal action against AstraZeneca, which would be in the Belgian courts under that particular contract. But at the end of the day, damages are not where it's at the moment. What every state wants to get is to get its hands on the vaccine. People are dying, people are getting sick, and they want to get those vaccines, get them produced, and get them going. So, you know, to that extent, the contractual remedy isn't giving the European Union what it wants. And that's why, essentially, they're looking at other remedies at the moment.
Finally then, seeing as you mentioned the Belgian courts, I did hear that the signing of the contract with AstraZeneca by the European Union would be enforceable under Belgian law, whereas the UK's contract with AstraZeneca would be enforceable under UK law, and therefore the UK's contract is tighter. Does that tally?
Contract law is pretty much contract law right across Europe, right across developed economies. There are certain different procedural requirements, for example, the requirement of consideration, what's called consideration under which is an act of forbearance or return promise under the common law, which exists in the United Kingdom and in Ireland. There'd be more of an emphasis on notarization on the continent. But ultimately speaking, contractual obligations are pretty much the same. You meet them or you end up being liable in damages under them. So I would expect, without being an expert in Belgian contract law, I would say that it's pretty near certain that the remedies in that regard are going to be pretty pretty much the same. Where I would say there may be some differences, that there probably was a difference of experience in terms of, you know, London is an international legal centre and a centre of commercial law. A lot of cases are litigated there. A lot of contracts all over the world are written in and specifically stated to be under the United Kingdom law. So they have a judiciary and they have lawyers who are well trained in drafting these contracts. And it is true that the contract with the United Kingdom was drafted in somewhat tighter terms, if you like, than the contract that was drafted with the European Union. But we've since discovered that that's not really where the difference is. That's not really where the point is. The point of conflict, if you want to call it that, is really not between the two contracts that were that advance purchase agreements that were arranged, but really between the advance purchase agreements with the European Union and the initial research agreement that was agreed with Oxford in the first place. So I don't really see it as being a battle between legal systems. I think it's just that, as I said, there was this confidential arrangement reached with Oxford, which was subsequently inherited when AstraZeneca partnered up with them. That has been the fly in the ointment, as it were. And as we saw, Matt Hancock clinging to that, telling the European Union, our contract trumps there. It's contract law. It's very straightforward. Well, guess what? The European Union has a legal device that trumps even that, and it's called a refusal of export authorizations. Now, we'll have to see if they actually agree on that as a result of the European Council meeting that's going on. There are certain countries that have reservations about increasing export authorization restrictions. There are arguments against it. You know, there are arguments that it could lead to tit-for-tat retaliation, you know, that it could spill over into other areas, and it could break up a very international market in vaccines and vaccine ingredients. But on the other hand, the reality of the matter is that, to put it really bluntly, the European Union states are effectively being made mugs of by this particular arrangement. And the free trade that supposedly exists in these vaccines is actually free trade in one direction only. What's going on is you have a free trade arrangement moving from European Union states, including Ireland, and towards the United Kingdom, and there is no free trade arrangement in the other sense. It's not being held back by export restrictions. It's being held back by Matt Hancock's favourite contractual clause.
All right. Well, that's a good point to end at. Professor Gavin Barrett, Jean Monnet Professor of Law in UCD, thanks very much for joining us on the Pandemic Podcast.
Very welcome.
And that's it for another episode in which a podcast doubled as a crash course in contract law, intrigue and geopolitical rivalry. Until next week, from me, Colm O'Mungoin, stay safe, take care. Thanks for listening.